Welcome back to Disturbing Interest, everyone. I am Regina King, your evil queen, and sitting in her own lovely house is my ever-beautiful partner.
Hi, I'm Lynn, your docent of darkness.
And distancing still.
And donuts, because apparently you get a free Krispy Kreme if you, like, show them your I got a COVID vaccine card. So
that is true.
Like, I needed more incentive, you know, to get one. I did not need that.
I'm just trying to find one.
Yeah, I will give you a donut if you'll give me a shot.
That's right. I will bake a fresh donut for you personally if you will come over here and shoot me up with that juicy, juicy, fousey juice.
I'm kind of like willing to, like, some guy in a corner out of his trunk, like, I got vaccines. I'm like, okay, at this point. Oh, okay.
Have you seen the South Park vaccine special?
I have not, no.
Oh my god, it is so funny. It is so funny. You should watch it just based on that comment alone.
I mean, shit, if they're like Windex works, Windex is fine with me at this point. I'm gonna go with Windex. I just want to go to the grocery store and not think, is today the day I die? That's all I want at this point.
I can't believe that, I can believe that cases are up 30% in Washington.
Oh, yeah. When they said we might be able to avoid a fourth wave, I was like, no, this is America. We're going to double down. 500,000 is not enough. We want to get to at least, 750 before the year's over? Come on, man. Got to get those death tolls higher. Jesus.
Yeah, for the rest of the world that is listening to us, we don't know why we like this. We don't know.
I don't. Yeah. I mean, I'm actually acting like it's December in the middle of horror right now. Even though, yes, I realize that we are extremely lucky to live in King County. We have the lowest rate for a metropolitan area our size in the country. But we're working.
That's because we got it first.
Right. We were like, oh, shit, that's no. Plus, again, we're all squirrely and weird and the indoorsy type here in Seattle.
There are a lot of outdoorsy type here, too.
Out in the forest, not like out in the eyeball-licking disco, you know? We're generally awkward here in the Pacific Northwest. There's the thing called the Seattle freeze, where people...
That is so true.
Yeah, people don't... Oh, hi. We're kind of like... It's not even that we're mean girls. We're just awkward loner types.
So for those of you out there who have never been to Seattle, who don't understand what the Seattle freeze is, what it is everyone is very icy, even though they might be polite. They're polite. They're not warm. And it takes about a year of living here before even your neighbors begin to thaw to you. So just Seattle freeze. It's a thing.
Yep. It's a very, I don't know, people talk about how maybe it's a Scandinavian thing, since there were a lot of Scandinavians that settled in here. But I'm like, everybody I know, well, not everybody, but a large proportion of the people I know that I actually talk to and interact with are not from here. They've all moved from somewhere else. So I don't know.
Entitlement thing. That's what it is.
I don't know. Maybe it's a seasonal affective disorder thing. We're all just too sad to go talk.
I don't want to talk to anyone else sad.
Okay, I'm going to stay inside and just watch Netflix and read. Yeah, I don't know. But I am not I'm socially awkward. I mean, I'm awkward, but I'm effusively awkward. Like, hello, hi. You know, I just natter. Like, that is how my anxiety and ADHD express themselves to the world, through babbling. As you may all know, you're like, no shit, really. So I tend to be like, how's it going? Okie dokie to, like, you know, everyone I meet. So I'm like the opposite of Seattle freeze, but it's okay.
I talk to people for a living, so that means that in my personal life, I don't want to talk to people. Unless I know you, I don't actually want to talk to you. And even then, there's a good chance that you may need to, like, schedule some time with me first.
I talk to inanimate objects. Like, I talk to my press, I talk to the paper, I talk to my cats all the time. Like, yeah, I have a running just commentary, so that's just how I am.
I have a legitimate conversation with my pets. Like, I am talking to a human. Yes. Yeah. Like, Yes. Which, speaking of, where are the little furballs? Oh, here they are. They're in the room with us recording. You may be able to see them at some point if you are one of our Patreon members. And for those of you out there who can, please feel free, sign up. We will send you a video and it will be worth tweezing my brows. Ooh. Just for you.
I tried making like a faux victory roll situation up here with the hair using my headband headset, because the story I'm going to tell you guys today is set in the 1940s during World War II. So I was trying to like theme it up, and mostly it just looks like Jersey Mall bangs. So sorry about that. I also did not put on beautiful, like you beat your face to the gods. I did nothing. I look like I have, my face has literally been beaten because I am old and tired.
I'm trying to practice putting on makeup again. One, because I enjoy putting on makeup and I forgot how much I enjoyed putting on makeup. But two, because I have an announcement. It's very exciting. I am going to be doing some plus size modeling at the end of next month. It will be socially distanced and safe, of course, because I'm going to keep on distancing and being safe until everyone in my house has a vaccine and it's safe to do so. But yeah, so I get to do a gothic steampunk plus size modeling thing. So I'm very excited.
Dance. Nice.
I know, right?
Very nice. And it's not like I'm doing a cool thing. It's more like, here's a cool thing that any of y'all could experience, even if you don't live in Seattle. So as you guys might know, I love the Seattle International Film Festival. That is my every year vacation to the world. And because of our friend Miss Rona, it's virtual! Woohoo! This year. So anybody anywhere with an internet connection can attend the festival. You can buy a full series pass, which is a kind of a commitment, both monetarily and time-wise, or you can just buy individual single tickets for screening. So go to SIFF.net, SIFF.net, and check out their offerings. And some of them look really cool. There is one film that I got to see a rough cut of a couple years ago, and it's called This Town, and it is a New Zealand production. And kind of think if Christopher Guest, but with a New Zealand kind of goofy, wacky, What We Do in the Shadows kind of sense of humor, made a mockumentary about true crime documentaries. It's the tits. It's fantastic.
What's the name again?
This Town.
This Town. This okay. Town.
Yeah, it's really, it's fun. It's a genuinely enjoyable movie, at least in the rough cut version that I saw. And I'm sure it's going to be even better now that it's got all the sound and everything's where it's supposed to go and all that sort of thing.
Will you add a link in our show notes?
I can. Yes. Once I see on SIFF where that is. And I will also on our social media, let you guys know, because it's genuinely a really fun, it's a fun film. You know, I think it does a fun job of skewering the way these documentaries tend to go and kind of making you go, why do you watch this? Why, what's up with this?
Come on. Why you like this?
Why are you like this?
So, I ask myself that daily.
Yeah. So anyway, I think it's enjoyable and I'll do my best to get the information to check it out, but it's called This Town. So yeah.
Ooh. Fun. That sounds like a good time right there.
I thought it was, so yeah.
My time has been just completely usurped lately with learning Japanese and doing work and trying to get through this allergy season that is trying to kill me, like always.
I sound like, and I'm through all the time. I don't have the Rona. I have trees having sex in my face. I did not consent to this. I don't want this, but that's where we're at.
We are in an unconsensual bokaki tree situation, and it's not okay. No. We're not okay. Send help.
It's gross. And I do love, I like gardening, because what else the fuck am I going to do, you know, really, at this time?
Anything but that. I am not going outside. I had a 2-day migraine straight. Has anyone out there had a 2-day migraine? Because I don't want to feel alone in this, but I don't want to wish it on anyone. It's like, when it's done, it feels like your head is it has everything. Everything feels like it could be oppressing you. It's like you can feel your sinuses. You can feel your teeth. Once the pain itself is done, yes, it's this hollow feeling of what the fuck just happened to me. It's like the trees came in and ran a train on my fucking brain against my wheel. I'm not okay. Not okay.
I get the optical kind. I am very lucky yes. in that I get the headache, but it's not a 2-day headache. It's a several hours, and I've never, knock wood, thrown up. But I get the thing where, like, I call it laser fluid in your mm-hmm. your brain. You get the zipper of light, and then I can see, instead of my peripheral vision going, my center of vision goes, and I can see the peripheral, and there's a big blind spot, and it is fairly terrifying, at least the first time or two that it happens, because you think, stroke? But no, just an optical migraine. Cool.
See, for me, I'm photosensitive, but I don't have the optics like that. What happens is it's like the colors get oversaturated on everything, and they're aggressive, and they attack me, like personally attack me. And I didn't do anything to the colors, but they're out to get me.
I don't love a migraine. It's for people that have never had one. It's not like, oh, I've got a headache. It's like all of, like, your brain stops being wired correctly. I end up with aphasia. Like, it's like you're having a mini stroke. Yeah. And it's, I do not care for it.
If it goes on for multiple days, aphasia and things like that last, like a hangover almost. Yes. You think to yourself, my brain is not working right.
And I get so exhausted that I think this is what being dead feels like. Migraines are genuinely scary even when you know what they are.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very lucky, knock all wood, that they were being triggered by working in social work. I don't do that job anymore. So y'all on your own. Mine came up during a very stressful time in my life. And also I had untreated astigmatism. So a lot of eye strain and things like that. So getting that taken care of, knowing my eye strain triggers, knowing to avoid like strobes and 3D movies. I can't, guys, because I go to migraine town. So can't do like Oculus Rift, any of that. I cannot join your charming husband in like whacking at air with sticks with his little VR headset on while he's playing golf and shit.
The weirdest thing about that is like normal 3D or VR, the way it used to be, can often make me sick. However, that VR, totally different. In fact, it's so bizarre. Like, you know, my eyes had that thing and then I developed an astigmatism, but close up. I thought that I wasn't going to be able to play that anymore because it's a VR. It's literally right in your face. It's in your face. Yeah. So how was I going to be able to focus on it, right? No, my eyes register it as being farsighted. It is so bizarre. It is so bizarre. But
I'm genuinely so anxious to do things like that, that I'm like, I'm not going to try that. I mean, it might be fine for me, but I was like, I don't want to poke the optical bear. Do not mm-hmm. poke the optical bear. So I just don't. Let me just say, I've never felt sicker than Avatar. Like, fuck you, James Cameron. Oh, like that. I mean, many people find Avatar sickening for the colonialism and the plot and all that.
I was just about to mention that.
I can't. It's for strictly technical reasons for me. I don't even know what the plot was because I was like, in my, yeah, no, can't do it. Cannot. Sorry.
I would have just left.
Yeah. Well, and I'm always like, oh, put them on, take them off, put them. Don't do that. That makes it worse. Yeah.
No.
I was trying, guys. I was trying to have the Avatar experience and my brain rebelled. My brain was like, no. No.
How do you feel about them reviving that whole franchise?
No, I'll be in the other room.
I think we're like 10 years too late.
Yeah, I'm good. I don't need Avatar. I'm fine. I'll go watch the Smurfs movie. If I want some weird blue animated shit, I'll just go watch me some Smurfs. Yeah, sounds good.
Dances with Smurfs. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So no
callback to another South Park reference.
Oh God! See, I haven't watched the South Park in years. I'm out of the cool. I watch.
They're satirical geniuses. They really are.
I just watch Bob's Burgers. I've been trying to watch The Great North, and because it's the same people that are behind some of Bob's Burgers, and I was like, I want to like this way more than I do. It felt very sort of forced, quirky, it felt Zooey Deschanel quirky in a way that I was not that into.
Prepared for.
Because they're very earnest, and I want to like it. And I feel like it started to get better. I think, again, I'm treating it like it's a new show. It's going to take a while to kind of get its groove in. So I'm liking it better, but I still, it's Bob's Burgers for me.
There's a show on Netflix you should watch. It's an animated show. I believe it's called Hilda. I think it's called Hilda.
Okay.
It's about this little girl who interacts with all of these fae folk in town and in the forest. And she treats them with respect instead of, you know, how people have treated them for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years of, you know, mistrust and hate, according to all our legends.
Them to become that Lucky Charms mascot, things like that.
That's right. Wear this motherfucking hat, motherfucker. Yeah, no, she's not forcing hats upon anyone. She's not shoving rainbows up their asses. It's actually quite a cute show, though. I highly recommend it. I was watching it thinking to myself, when I was a child, this is the shit I would have been all about. And been like, I want to be Hilda when I grow up.
I used to leave bowls of cereal out for, much to my mother's dislike, because obviously gnomes aren't real. I would leave this bowls of cereal out for gnomes because we had the gnome book. Remember the gnome book that was the late 70s, early 80s? So I was like, I want to get some gnomes up in this house. So I would like try to lure them. I wasn't going to do nefarious things. I just wanted to like win their love. You know what? It doesn't attract gnomes. It does attract rats. So that's a thing. But yeah, it was so I would have definitely been Hilda. Yeah.
I really wanted to be friends with David the Gnome. Do you remember the cartoon David the Gnome? He rode around on a fox.
No, I never saw. I just had.
Oh my God. I wanted to be friends with David the Gnome. I wanted to ride with him on his fox, but I wouldn't be tiny enough. And it was the dream, David the Gnome.
Yeah. Well, there's no gnomes in today's story, unfortunately. It's all very real. But for once, there's not actual horrible murder. I mean, there is the death of millions, because we're going to talk about everybody's favorite shitheels, the Nazis. But it's actually about terrible things happening to Nazis rather than Nazis doing terrible things to people. So, you know, it's
good.
It does involve lying, cheating, deception, fraud, and art forgery. This has everything. Like, so I'm very excited about this show, but I thought it's a nice break from murder. It's pretty murder-free, but it's I think you'll enjoy this one.
Don't worry. In our next episode, when we come back, I'm sure we will have many murdery things to bring you. Something disturbing.
Yeah. My next story is totally about murder. It's more modern. I seem to be into like the 90s these days. So this is like 90s, early 2000s, and Norway and metal. So
das metal.
Yes. So we're going to do some metal. Metal murders. But yeah, this one, very low-key in the murder. But first, let me crack open my delicious can. Which shows Amble and Chase. This one actually looks nice.
It does.
Rosé.
You have to wonder, though, Amble and Chase, do you think that they were like, I like the word amble, but we need to give it something a little edgy. What's the opposite of ambling? Chasing somebody. Amble and Chase.
I think these are actually Statler and Waldorf's modern hipster, like, great-great-great-nephews. It's my choose to believe. Yeah, there's really nothing hilarious about this. I just was like, this seemed actually like something that might taste good, so I bought it. So I'm going to crack into it and see. Ooh, it does not want to give up its goods. Come here, you. No, it's really not. Come on, you bastard. It does not want to open. There we go. Oh, no. God damn it, I can't even operate a pop can. All right, there we go. Oh, very good. I mean, it smells like wine. It doesn't smell frightening or like cough syrup, so there's that.
Yay.
I mean, it's fine. It's pretty low key. Like it's a very dry rosé. I don't know why I expected it would be fizzy. It's not. Yeah, it's a really pleasant. It's a very European Euro rosé.
Nice.
Cause like often rosé in the United States tends to be like pink Zinfandel. No. Rosé can be a whole range of things, and it's not like we mixed red wine. I want pink wine. No. It's leaving the skins on and things like that. So, but yeah, this is a nice rosé. I like it, and it's sort of looking out the window. It's kind of sunny out, so I'm gonna pretend like it's like a rosé day here. Rosé.
I've got the sun, as you can see.
Yeah, I got good light.
It is hitting me. Yeah, got good light going on. Light, I myself
light behind me.
You do. I myself am drinking a lychee jasmine, not milk tea, yeah, with less sweetening.
Is there boba?
Not boba, but jellies, lychee jellies.
Good. Yes. I couldn't see the little brown. I was like, but there might be some chunky things that you want in your tea. Not chunky.
This is my favorite drink. I get it once a week, and it makes me very happy.
All right, well, my whistle has been wetted, so let me just plunge into our tale. So, picture it. Austria, 1945.
That's not a happy place to be.
No. A giant complex of subterranean tunnels carved into the shores of Lake Altaussee for the purposes of mining salt. But for the last several years, they've been the cavernous tomb for thousands of Europe's greatest art treasures, looted during World War II by everyone's favorite total sacks of shit, the Nazis. Adolf Hitler himself had commanded these treasures to be gathered together to form the basis of his planned Führer Museum in Linz, Austria, which would essentially be the Smithsonian, Nazi style. By the war's end, the salty storage depot contained 6,577 paintings, 137 sculptures, and 484 crates of other art, as well as furniture, weapons, coins, and library collections. Some of the most famous pieces that had been stolen and stored there included Michelangelo's Madonna of Bruges and Jan van Eyck's Ghent altarpiece that were both looted from churches in Belgium, many paintings from the Capodimonte Museum in Naples, which I had the great good fortune of seeing some of those when the collection was on tour at the Seattle Art Museum.
Oh, that's cool.
Years ago, including an Artemisia Gentileschi, which was like, I'm a museum crier. Gesundheit.
Thank you. Dankeschön.
Maybe you're allergic to Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're allergic to Nazis.
I'm allergic to cherry trees, and we live in Washington. Anyway, please continue. So you're a museum crier. I get that. I have cried at a museum before.
Yeah. I am definitely into weeping. Like, I'm so beautiful. Yeah, I'm a space crier. Like when I see like we're going to space, I'm like, it's so beautiful. Humans in space. Oh my God, they're landing something on Mars. Like I am a crier for that.
I can't say I'm a space crier, but I am a museum crier. I have cried at a Matisse before. I have cried in front of some beautiful works of art, and that's moved me to tears.
Let's normalize public crying. I mean, people have feelings. Let's just have feels.
I think we did in 2020, didn't we?
Let's keep that. Let's keep that. It's okay to have feelings energy going forward.
We definitely normalized seeing people break down in the middle of the street screaming naked in Seattle during 2020. So yeah, why not?
Maybe not quite. Like if somebody's doing that, let's normalize getting that person some help. Yeah, we'll help. But yeah.
And clothes.
Clothes are a form of help. But yeah. Okay. But yes, moving on. And in the salt mines were two paintings by Johannes Vermeer.
Ooh.
He's going to play a very large part in our overall story today. So in April 1945, as the Allied troops advanced upon the salt mines, August Eygruber, who was the person in charge of the location, gave orders to blow it up, preferring to destroy hundreds of years of history and beauty rather than to allow it to fall into the hands of the Allies.
Because you know what? That guy was a real eye goober.
He wasn't. He's totally an eye goober. Because you know what? Nazis, they fucking suck like that. Hitler himself actually countermanded that order because even that utter fucking monster understood the importance of the stolen treasures. But after his death, Eigruber was like, fuck it. We're blowing it up anyway. Big middle finger going out in a blaze of infamy. But luckily for everybody, that order was actually never carried out, despite the fact that Eigruber had embedded 8 50-kilogram bombs into the tunnels. So the U.S. Army instead snuck into the tunnels in the dead of night on May 3rd and dug up the bombs, and then instead blew up smaller, strategically placed charges at the entrance to the mine that both kind of bluffed Eigruber and made him think that, yes, in fact, it had been carried out, and it also prevented the Nazis from entering the mines to take away or destroy any of the artworks there while the army secured the area. And on May 8, 1945, the U.S. Army's Monuments Men officially seized the Altaussee salt mines and began the work of rescuing and repatriating all the stolen art and making restitution to its former owners, which is a process that's still going on today, given that a lot of the former owners had also been killed by the Nazis because they were Jews. And a side note on the Monuments Men, which also included some Monuments Women, this was the nickname given to the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives Program, or the MFAA, that was established by the Allied armies in 1943 to help protect and preserve cultural treasures during and after World War II. Basically, it was an elite squad of art historians, archivists, and museum personnel comprised of 345 men and women from 13 countries who eventually found over 1,000 hidden caches of art containing an estimated 5 million pieces of art and cultural items that had been stolen from Jews, from museums, universities, churches across Europe and Asia. Now, some of the troves were not from Nazi looters. Some were hidden caches of art from museums, churches, private owners that had been hidden to protect them from theft by the invading Axis forces. But the majority was, in fact, thanks to a systemic program of stripping the land of its cultural treasures to be held then by the Nazi regime in perpetuity.
Now, if I remember correctly, recently, within the last, I want to say, 10 or 15 years, they found a Da Vinci that had been damaged by water after being hidden away from a small cathedral, and they didn't realize it was a Da Vinci because it had been painted over and it had water damage, and mm-hmm. they were able to go back and do testing on it and actually uncover the painting underneath the original, and that was how they knew it was a Da Vinci. Am I correct in that?
Probably. There's been a number of occasions where people have found cached art in that kind of capacity, but yeah, I that would not in any way surprise me.
So, hopefully I'm right. Hopefully that wasn't just a puff of smoke up your skirts, guys. But I'm telling you, that happened with a Da Vinci.
I think
a Da Vinci.
Well, we can look it up later.
We can bonus
content. So one of the chief plunderers of the Third Reich was Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring. This giant bastard loved
this giant bag of dicks.
He was a literal giant bag of dicks. People made fun of how fat he was all the time, and I'm not into body shaming, but I am into Nazi shaming, so fuck that guy at any size. And looting, oh my god, it was his raison d'etre. He was awesome at stealing people's art and antiquities. Loved it. He was like evil Indiana Jones. Although, again, we can talk about... is that ever a good thing? Like, oh boy, it's a thorny... taking antiquities from where they are held is a giant thorny issue. And in this particular case, it's super damn clear-cut. Like, just Nazis stealing shit, bad, 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 bad.
Nazis aren't good.
No.
Nazis aren't good. If you find yourself at any point in any time in history on the same side as Nazis. If you find yourself agreeing with something that Nazis agree with, maybe reconsider it. Like if the Nazis came up and were like, the sky is blue, I would be sitting there going, maybe an aquamarine. Maybe an aquamarine. Yeah. It's no longer that blue. Go away.
Blue's going to come up later on in this whole situation. So hold that thought. You're prescient. Not Prussian, but prescient. Anyway, so basically, yeah, Goering lived to plunder art, and he himself kept a large personal art gallery at his estate, Carenhall, that was itself essentially built on the riches that he obtained by confiscating the money and possession of European Jews. And
that bag of dicks would name his house Carenhall.
Well, it was actually, that part is a little bit sweet. Karen was the name of his late wife. So,
and she was probably a Karen.
And she's probably glad to be dead, because then she's not married to this asshole again. So, yeah. Carenhall. Yeah. So, his notoriety as an appropriator of stolen art goods was so wide that a popular joke that his own men made about him was that he had sent a wire to Hitler after his visit to the Vatican stating, "Mission accomplished. Pope unfrocked. Tiara und pontifical vestments are a perfect fit." Yep. Yeah, there's a joke about him stealing the fucking Pope's clothes. Yeah. Yeah. Now, this tacky bastard was also known to love outlandish outfits and just, like, decking everything out like he's fucking Liberace in, like, jewels and gold. He once wore this big fancy fur coat out, and people were like, "That looks like the fanciest fur coat of a whore." So, like, you know, like people mocked this guy because he was Liberace levels of just over the top fucking tacky. I mean,
God, I'm sitting here kind of respecting the extraness because I am an extra person.
But, like,
as anyone who can see who is on our Patreon right now, I'm a little extra. But I mean, bottom line, I can't get behind Nazi, and now I'm rethinking all of my life choices.
Well, you can be extra in the service of not evil. That's totally a possible thing, you know? But I'm just setting the scene for who this dude is. I mean, understated and elegant, he was not. And, like, in general, Nazi...
Someone who would wear the Pope's hat
while
having the picnic, he was.
Yes, yes. That is very much him. Like, so, okay, in general, Nazi art is, it's very, you know, think bland propaganda paintings, this the blonde Mädchen, and just kind of cheesy fantasy hunting in, you know, the Austrian forest and shit like that. That's kind of, that was their, right up their alley, right? Anything modern, anything avant-garde was considered degenerate art. That's what they would call it and destroy it. And they really, really, really loved that old masters kind of thing. Like paintings from the Dutch Golden Age. And they had a particular hard-on for Vermeer.
Didn't they have a particular hard-on for Botticelli, too?
Just pretty much anything that is old school, classical, Renaissance. They were like, this is it. This is the apotheosis of art. And anything weird and modern, just no, we're not doing that. So we want this old masters, old school situation. I have to say that I am kind of sad about the fact that these assholes love Vermeer, because I love Vermeer. These paintings are rad. Like, it's just gorgeous. They glow. And you know what I'm saying here? You can totally love Vermeer and definitely also not be a Nazi. Just like you can totally love extra... fur coats, not real ones, because that's kind of mean, but, like, you know, over the top, gold, jewels, etc., and not be a fucking Nazi, or an art forger, or an otherwise not so great person. So I'm not saying that, like, Vermeer is Nazi. I'm saying that the Nazis particularly liked him because, you know, even a stopped clock is right twice a day, right?
We're saying that the Nazis were dicks because they stole Vermeer's. That's what we're saying.
Right. So... yeah, Goering really loved Vermeer. And I think he's also kind of like a label whore, if you will, you know, which is a problem with a lot of art collection today. And not even a problem, but like, it's about owning a particular label, not necessarily whether you connect with that work, but saying, being able to say, well, I have a Pollock, I have a Rothko.
I have a Banksy. You saw that one just sold for several million.
Right. So it's a thing. It's being able to possess a label, like having a Louis Vuitton, you know, that kind of thing. And the fact that Goering loved Vermeer is kind of a problem for him, because there really are not many Vermeer paintings left in existence that are definitely attributable to him. So in the 19th century, when he was kind of rediscovered, and art historians were like, wow, this guy's actually pretty cool, it was thought that there were around 60, 66 pictures of his. But by this point in time, modern art historians believe that there are only about 34 that are definitively his works. So in any case, Vermeers are rather thin on the ground, even for the Prince of Thieves, Hermann Goering, who had access to basically looting all the collections of occupied Europe. And that is where the actual protagonist of our story today, Han von Meegeren, comes in. Yeah, it took me a page and a half to actually introduce this guy, because I'm a stellar storyteller, folks, but again, wanted to set the scene for y'all. So, Henricus Antonius von Meegeren was born in Deventer in the Netherlands on October 10th, 1889. He was the third of five children from an extremely middle-class, middle-of-the-road, stodgy, stiff, an absolutely not art-focused at all Catholic family that was headed by one Henricus von Meegeren, who was an instructor at the local teacher's college, and his wife Augusta. So Henricus Sr. was a real martinet. He was a pinch-ass, middle-class dick. He basically forced his older son Hermann to attend seminary to become a priest because he thought that would be a really great way to get his family some class. And poor Hermann eventually died while at seminary, probably because he was despairing. He didn't want to be there. He'd run away once before, but his father forced him to go back. And
so this poor kid just pined himself to death.
Yeah.
Jesus.
And this was something that Han von Meegeren held against his dad his whole life. But, you know, even if that had never happened, he had plenty to be mad about. So, essentially, even though from the time he was little, Han von Meegeren was obsessed with art and wanting to become a painter and an artist, Henricus the Senior was just horrified by his younger son's interest in art. And at several points in the boy's childhood, he forced young Han, when he would catch him drawing or doing kind of little pranks, to write 100 times, "I know nothing, I am nothing, I am capable of nothing."
Fuck this guy.
Right? This guy's a giant. You don't have to be a Nazi to be a complete fucking dick, you know? So yeah. And he is really parent of the fucking year, isn't he? Now, luckily...
Oh, definitely father of the year.
Oh yeah, this guy's great. Luckily, Han's mother, Augusta, was a kinder person and secretly encouraged her son's interest in art and would buy him art supplies on the sly.
Yeah,
you know, I know. And Han was also lucky enough that one of his school friends' fathers was a painter and an art instructor, and he was able to take private lessons kind of on the DL with this dad. And this guy
was sweet. At least he had people in his life
he did.
Who were encouraging to him.
Yeah, this guy was basically kind of his mentor and an alternative father figure as he was growing up. And interestingly enough, he also, this was where Han first learned how to mix pigments the old-fashioned way and in the style of the old Dutch masters. So at this point in the history of painting in Europe, we're kind of looking at like the very early, like 1900s, kind of turn of the century. Companies like Winsor and Newton, who still are around today, I'm guessing you've probably bought some pigments from them, they had started to make professionally mixed tubes of color that were widely available, and many artists just stopped making their own paint because, frankly, it's a pain in the ass.
It is a bitch.
Yeah, and it can be toxic, especially at that time, dangerous, expensive, depending on what you're making.
I mean, especially now, it can be very expensive.
Right. Well, And, you know, like, technically, I could mix my own lamp black or bone black for making prints, but fuck that. I'm not going to do that. That's a mess. Just no. I mean, I have a printer friend who's awesome, and he does that. He makes his own ink, and he makes his own paper, and he's a better man than me. You're a better man than me, dude, to be sure. But I'm a lazy, messy bitch, and I'm okay with that. And, yeah. But I digress. So, essentially, you know, young Han is forced by his father then to go to architecture school as a compromise, because that is a solid middle class art adjacent profession that can earn him a steady paycheck and bring respectability to the Van Meegeren name, right?
You know, that is fair. It is art adjacent. It is respectable. I could get behind that as somebody who is in business and also an artist. I could have gone into being an architect and been very happy with that. However, I didn't have an overbearing father or mother who said, "You cannot paint."
And that is basically what happened here.
Yeah.
Again, no slam on people who are architects. That's a hell of a thing. But Han did not want to do that. But off he still goes, because this was his option, to Delft, to the technical college there, to study architecture. And Delft, coincidentally, happens to be the home of the late, great Johannes Vermeer. And so he takes drawing and painting classes along with the rest of his architectural classes. And he actually ends up designing the boathouse for the rowing club at the college that is still there.
And, oh, wow.
Yeah. And even though he's, you know, he apparently does very well in his classes, he never actually sits his final examinations because he doesn't want to be an architect, you know?
Yeah, but if you go all the way through school, you would think.
Yeah, that's not how he thinks. That's
okay.
What he wants to know. Now, at this time, he also meets a lovely art student, Anna DeVogt, while at school, and they fall in love. And she gets pregnant, so they end up getting married in April of 1912. And honestly, from, you know, the things I've read a couple books on this guy, Anna seems like a super nice lady. She really does. But, oh man, Han, he's kind of dicky and a bit of a megalomaniac. Like, he does not seem like a great husband. And he's really, really talented at art. In fact, so much so that he receives the gold medal in art prize that the university in Delft gives for this watercolor. It is the study of the interior of the Church of St. Lawrence. But wow. He's also kind of prideful. And he thinks that teaching or going into commercial art, which he did try, is kind of beneath him, despite the fact that he's got a growing family to help provide for. So, you know, now, okay, to be fair, commercial art, yeah, dude, I've been there. It's a job, you know. Is it art? No, it's okay. But he doesn't do a great job at it because it's about making what a client wants and making it fast. And that's not what he does. It's not how he rules.
I'm just going to interject something here because that's what I'm here to do today. As somebody who paints for a hobby and not a living, I definitely respect the hard work that goes into, like, what you and friend of the show, Lacey Nishtoom, do. You guys work really hard. I see you hustle. I see other professional artists hustle. You work that money maker every freaking hour of the day. I get it.
Capitalism. It's capitalism, baby. We're all there. Yeah.
Yeah. But a lot of people out there either do not have the drive ability to do that. And some would kill for it. But at a certain point, when you are, you know, hundreds of years in the past and the sole breadwinner for your growing family as the male of the house, you would think that you would do the respectable thing and just bite the bullet, do the commercial art job, and get paid, and quit acting like your shit doesn't stink.
Well, I mean, he does get a little better. He gets better at it. So he's okay. Not doing, you know, he doesn't like teaching. And teaching also doesn't pay very well, but he also really thinks it's kind of beneath him. He hates the commercial art world. And he just, you know, but at the same time, he has a taste for kind of the finer things and living the high life. But he has no way to properly afford them. So they end up borrowing money from Anna's grandmother and living above her apartment. And it
if you have to live above Nana's apartment, take the commercial job. Take the teaching job.
And Anna works really hard to promote her husband's work as an artist. She works on getting him a solo show and all of this kind of thing. And he does eventually end up on the radar of some wealthy folks. And he makes a pretty decent living for a while painting portraits of the fancy tourist crowd from America and the UK who've come to the continent to winter in France, the Côte d'Azur. So basically he paints flattering portraits of the nouveau riche. Okay?
Good for him.
So that's good. Now, yeah. He also ends up cheating on poor Anna, and she eventually kicks this ass to the curb and moves to Paris with their two children, Jacques and Inez. And Jacques actually eventually becomes a painter who comes back in his father's later years to kind of help him kind of, you know, get through what we'll talk about at the end of this. But, you know, they live in Paris and he does visit a few times, but he kind of basically abandons the family. And eventually Anna moves back to Sumatra in Indonesia, where she grew up and where much of her family's, her mother's family still lives. So now that he's alone, Han van Meegeren starts to turn his hand to the thing that will actually become the very lucrative part of his art production business. Forgeries. So in this time, he marries an actress, Johanna Orlemans, and they begin to live kind of a bohemian, groovy, upper-class party life. And through, though his ability to paint very pleasing portraits of the upper class, and he's got a lot of talent for making work in the style of the old masters, and this earns him money, the actual Dutch art critics and the art community really disdain him and look down on him. And remember,
probably now, because he was a dick.
Well, and also, remember, this is the 1920s, 30s. This is the era when cubism, surrealism, and all kind of like wild and crazy modernity is just floating across the art world. And, like, stodgy old Han van Meegeren and his old master shit, so last century, girl. You know, it's just, he's, no.
It wasn't what was trending.
It was not, no, he was not. He was yesterday's news. And one art critic wrote that he was, quote, a gifted technician who has made a sort of composite facsimile of the Renaissance school. He has every virtue except originality. Ooh, sick art history, burn!
Ooh.
Yeah. Ooh, yee. So, stung by this critique, van Meegeren ends up publishing a bunch of severely salty articles in a monthly magazine that he publishes himself called The Grouse. Yeah, so basically this is the early 20th century version of a blog, right? It's a blog.
Yeah.
And, I mean, like, today he would, like, have tweeted this, right? And he denounced modern painting as art Bolshevism and referred to the proponents of modernism as, quote, a slimy bunch of woman haters and Negro lovers. And he symbolized the international art market as a Jew with a handcart. Yikes, hon! Not cool! Yeah, like,
I'm saying
this guy's cool. I'm not. I'm just like, yeah.
There's so much wrong with this man. I'm trying to be in his corner because he's, like, the base of our story, but I just can't be. I mean, he had a shitty childhood, but he's a shitty human being.
Well, okay, so basically this is dicks hurting bigger dicks. So again, nobody in this is like, oh, you know, the coolest of the cool. It's just an interesting players getting played by players, I guess, is what I'm trying to say here. Yeah.
What we're saying is we have brought you an entire bag of dicks today.
We have. I mean, this is disturbing interest, not cool people from art. We could do that show, but that's not what we're doing.
That's not us. No.
No. So he decided his ultimate revenge on the world of the art critics would be to create the ultimate forgery. And he moved to the south of France with his wife in 1932, where he rented a mansion and began his career in forgery in deep earnest. He researched the various compounds and methods that the old masters used to make their paints, and he purchased authentic 17th century canvases to paint on. He even made his own badger hair brushes of the kind Vermeer was known to use, and he mixed up the wildly expensive ultramarine blue, which was made from crushed lapis lazuli, the gemstone, and that was Vermeer's signature color. And he even developed a technique of using phenol formaldehyde, aka bakelite, so like the bakelite jewelry and kind of protoplastic, if you will, to cause the paints to harden and form the craquelure across the surface, which is that kind of crackling and crusting yep. that the paint and the varnish gets over time. And it would cause them to look like they were hundreds of years old. And
that's then, amazing.
Yeah, I mean...
And Vermeer really is... So anyone who is not a big art buff, just look at some of the paintings because the light and the color is amazing. Amazing. And the lapis lazuli ultramarine blue, aquamarine blue that he used, it really did just shine.
Oh yeah, and it was expensive. That was kind of a signature. Mm-hmm. And it was usually used very sparingly and a lot in religious paintings to kind of symbolize, you know, the preciousness of the Virgin Mary and things like that. But
yeah.
Vermeer was like, fuck this shit, I'm going to put it on everything. This is my secret sauce. And he just kind of threw it on everything, right? Which is part of the reason people are like, ooh, you know? So yeah, but he would also take thin down India ink and he would roll that across the surface to get down into that, those cracks and crevices to make it simulate years and years of smoke and dirt.
That's brilliant.
Oh yeah. I feel like Julian Baumgartner from the Baumgartner Restoration YouTube that I am obsessed with would have been both horrified and like, damn, that is impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it took over 6 years for Van Meegeren to really get his technique down. But once he did, the man was a fake factory. And in 1936, he painted his ultimate forgery masterpiece, The Supper at Emmaus, which was an ersatz, a fake Vermeer, based on Caravaggio's Supper at Emmaus, real painting, because art historians assumed that Vermeer had studied in Italy and that he would have seen and appreciated this painting. And then Van Meegeren had it appraised by a leading art historian of the time, Abraham Bredius, who pronounced it the masterpiece of Johannes Vermeer of Delft. And the fake it then went on to sell to the Rembrandt Society for 520,000 florins, or in today's dollars, $5.5 million.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
He was able to buy that McMansion he was renting.
In fact, then he and his wife went on to buy a 12-bedroom estate in Nice with the proceeds of that sale, and Van Meegeren then continued his very lucrative career as a forger, earning probably between $25 and $30 million in today's money over the course of the next 5 years. Well, looks like crime does pay, motherfuckers! At one point, he owned over 50 houses around the Laren in the Netherlands. Yeah, he was like he had so much stuff.
He became a real estate mogul.
Right? And the Van Meegerens lived a wildly luxurious lifestyle, even during the war. Now, lest you think this was all peaches and cream and happiness for this crafty old fox, Van Meegeren's health declined thanks to his heavy drinking, chain smoking, and his addiction to morphine sleeping pills. Yeah. Living a life based on a lie, even and especially a very lucrative one, is going to lead to a lot of anxiety about getting caught, and I like to hope a little bit of guilt about how he's generating these funds. And then, when your forged art gets sold to one of the top Nazis, you really, really, really start sweating bullets. Ironically, Van Meegeren was probably safer from being found out at this stage because all of the genuine Vermeers his work might have been compared to were all being carefully hidden by the institutions who owned them so that they didn't fall into Nazi hands. And so the only available Vermeers for shitheels like Goering to get his slimy paws on
were the fake
ones. Exactly. They were the forgeries by Van Meegeren. This is, I mean, God bless. This is awesome. So Goering traded 137 looted actual, like, real paintings for Van Meegeren's one fake Vermeer, Christ with the Adulteress, in 1942. And he initially showcased it at his art gallery in his estate, Caranhal, but eventually he stashed it about a year later in the salt mine at Alta Aussie for safekeeping. And it was there in 1945 that Monuments Man, Captain Harry Anderson, discovered it. The Allies questioned the art dealer Alois Meidel, who had sold the painting to Goering, about its origins, and eventually tracked the painting back to Van Meegeren, who was arrested and charged on May 29, 1945, with fraud and aiding and abetting the enemy. Now, at this point, they think it's a real Vermeer, right? And this charge of collaboration and plundering Dutch cultural property carried a potential death sentence. So Van Meegeren was in kind of a pickle right now. Does he fess up to being a forger and potentially forfeit all of his assets and end up in jail for fraud? Or does he keep quiet and be charged with essentially treason and end up hanged? So eventually deciding that life in jail was, and, you know, possible penury, was preferable to the hangman's noose, Van Meegeren confessed, saying, "The painting in Goering's hands is not, as you assume, a Vermeer of Delft, but a Van Meegeren. I painted the picture." And to prove the truth of that statement, Van Meegeren was then ordered to produce a genuine fake while in prison, and he did just that. He painted his very last forgery, Jesus Among the Doctors, between July and December of 1945 while he was incarcerated and in the presence of reporters and court-appointed witnesses. He was released from prison in January of 1946 and went from being a vilified Nazi collaborator and traitor to the Dutch culture to being a great hero of the war for defrauding the Nazis. And he still had to stand trial, though, because, again, charge of forgery.
He defrauded a lot of other people.
Yeah. So, like, out of the frying pan into the different frying pan. And a commission of art historians and scientists were then convened, and they examined the 8 Vermeer and Van Hals paintings that Van Meegeren admitted to forging, and they did indeed determine that they were very clever fakes, but that the dirt, which was really India ink, in the cracks was way too even, and that the crackalure itself was also far too consistent to have been formed naturally over time. And on November 12, 1947, Van Meegeren was found guilty of forgery and fraud and sentenced to a year in prison. And while he was home waiting to be transferred into the prison after his sentence had been passed, Han Van Meegeren suffered a fatal heart attack brought on by the stress of the trial and the sentencing and compounded by years of hard living, and died on November 26, 1947 at the age of 58.
And after without ever serving a day besides those 5 months when he was being observed.
Correct. And after his death, his assets were auctioned off to pay off both income taxes and to refund the buyers of his forged paintings. Now, he transferred about $50 million in today's money to his wife, ex-wife, Jo, who he had divorced during the war, not because he didn't want to live with her, they were still living together, but for financial purposes, and whose innocence of his crimes he consistently professed during the trial. And she was able to keep that money and live a pretty luxurious life for many years until her death at the age of 91. Now, it's probably likely she knew exactly what he was doing, but he wanted to provide for her and for his kids, and so that's what he did.
And the interesting thing, so I've seen a documentary or two about this case itself, but if I'm correct, his paintings have kind of their own glow about them today because, okay. Yes. Absolutely.
So some of Van Meegeren's forgeries now reside in the permanent collections of major museums around the world, including the Rijksmuseum, which holds a number of actual Vermeers. And they've toured to other museums, and they have been displayed alongside the original Old Masters because they are such good, they're such good examples of that style.
And they are amazing paintings. Yeah. Bottom line is they were so well done, people thought they were actually Vermeers. They were so well done. He was an amazing artist. Yeah. So today, those paintings themselves are seen as masterpieces.
Yes, absolutely. And in the end, despite the fact that Han von Meegeren's reasons for committing these forgeries probably honestly come down to the fact that it was a hell of a lucrative enterprise, he is still regarded by many Dutch people as this kind of cunning trickster who fooled and defrauded a host of pompous experts, and most importantly, he screwed over the truly hateful Nazi monster, Hermann Göring. And as a result, he's a pretty popular guy, and his paintings still sell for quite a lot of money. So, yeah.
That is an amazing story. That's a great story.
No murder, just a lot of fraud. So much fraud. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the last time I brought you a lot of fraud with murder.
With murder,
so.
I am.
Yeah.
This is just like a light version. Just all the fraud, none of the murder, you know.
But art, which is art, amazing. Yeah. And Nazis.
Nazis.
And yeah. Anytime you can screw over a Nazi, it's a good time.
You should do it. If you can fuck over a Nazi, fucking do it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's my story.
Yay! Yeah. Thank you very much. That was a great story.
No problem.
All right. Well, I guess on that note, then, everyone out there, take care of each other.
Stay the hell indoors. It's not over. Be careful.
That's right. That's right. Just stay inside. And remember, you might be disturbed, but you're not.
Not a forger. Or maybe you are. And you're not alone.
And you're not alone.
Thank you for listening, friends. Remember, if you would like to reach out to us, you can find us on Facebook at The Disturbing Interest Podcast, Twitter at podcast_DI, Instagram at DI Podcast. You can find us online at disturbinginterest.com, or you can email us at disturbinginterest@gmail.com. Our P.O. Box is 70515 Seattle, Washington 98127. Remember to rate, like, and tell your friends, and we'll talk at you soon.